The Los Annabelle Times is made possible in part by a grant from the Kenwood Silverton Madera Kiwanis, Incorporated. Good afternoon, everyone. This is John Pauley with this week's edition of Los Annabelle Times. I've been reading from the book Hidden History of Cincinnati, written by Jeff Seuss, and it's basically a book written to kind of give you an idea of some of the things you may not be aware of in Cincinnati's history, things that are not exactly evident and aren't forefront and mainstream, but all the same, we're a big part of Cincinnati's history. We're back right now in the early settlers part, the battles with the Indians and things like that. We've gotten to where in the spring, Captain Henry Byrd led British troops and Indians into Kentucky, captured two American forts, and they murdered Captain Richard Callaway. And now we're working on a retaliation for those attacks. Clark has amassed 1,000 men, including Daniel Boone and Simon Kenton, and they're on a campaign to punish the Shawnee. I just read an account from Abraham Thomas, who was with Daniel Boone, kind of acting as spies on to check out the situation ahead of when the 1,000 men got to that point, and I'll pick up where I left off. At the site, the forest everywhere was thick set with heavy beech and scattering underbrush of spicewood and pawpaw. Here, Clark's men cut timber to erect a stockade as an advance base. The structure, a little place stockaded in, saplings 10 feet long set on end, was the first built in Cincinnati. The next day, Clark and his men headed north to Old Chillicothe. Finding it abandoned, Clark burned the village and cornfields and continued to Piqua, also known as Pickaway, near present-day Springfield, and rousted the Shawnees there. It was the only significant engagement in Ohio during the war, and they're talking about the Revolutionary War. Although the British surrender at Yorktown on October 19, 1781, effectively ended the Revolutionary War, the treaty was not signed for another 2 years, and in the West, skirmishes continued between the Indians and Kentucky settlers. In August 1782, Indians and British loyalists ambushed and routed Boone and the Kentucky militia at Blue Licks on the Licking River in what is now Robinson County, Kentucky. Though the defeat had no real impact on the Revolution, the Battle of Blue Licks was the last major engagement in the war and triggered another retaliatory campaign from Clark, now a brigadier general, against the Shawnee villages. In early November, Clark, and this is George Rogers Clark, again took 1,000 men with Boone and Kenton across the river at the future Cincinnati site and marched to Piqua, but they found the village deserted and the Indians unwilling to fight. Captain William McCracken, who had been lured into an ambush and shot, died on the return trip as they descended the hills into the Cincinnati Basin. He was buried in the blockhouse Clark had built near where Main Street would later approach the river. They then burned the log house. Clark and the troops agreed to meet at that spot, or possibly across the river in Kentucky, exactly 50 years later to the day. In November 1832, only a handful of the survivors planned to make that meeting. Clark and Boone had died. Kenton was one of 15 to attempt the trip. But a cholera outbreak swept through Cincinnati, and the reunion was canceled. The first biography of Daniel Boone appeared shortly after the war, in 1784, as an appendix to The Discovery, Settlement, and Present State of Kentucky by John Filson. The narrative, purported to be The Adventures of Colonel Daniel Boone, in Boone's own words, though written by Filson, was an unabashed advertisement for the Western frontier, where Filson was invested in settlements. He was a partner, along with Matthias Denman and Colonel Robert Patterson, in founding a settlement opposite the Licking River. Filson was the surveyor for the site, which he named Losantiville, by cobbling together syllables from different languages to mean city opposite the Licking River. Around October 1, 1788, Filson disappeared while exploring the Miami woods and was never seen again. It was presumed that he was killed by Indians. Israel Ludlow took over his shares and served as the new surveyor when Losantiville was founded on December 28th of that year. The name was changed to Cincinnati 12 months later. And now we move on to Chapter 3, The Hearty Boys, Hearty, H-E-A-R-T-Y, The Hearty Boys of America. History has not been kind to the graves of the soldiers of the American Revolution. Untold numbers of veterans who fought to secure this country's independence lie in unmarked graves. Some have been lost entirely. After the war, many soldiers were given bounty land grants in exchange for their service in the Continental Army or militia, and they headed westward into the territories beyond the 13 original colonies. When the Patriots died, they were buried in remote rural spots or urban graveyards close to town. Sanitarians in those days believed the miasma theory. Vapors or bad air from decaying corpses were a cause of illness. As a result, many of those graveyards were covered over. Some graves were relocated to idyllic suburban cemeteries. Others were left underground, and buildings like Cincinnati's Music Hall were erected above them. Burial records of that period are so poor that the identities of remains will probably never be known. Thanks to efforts of the Daughters of the Revolution and the Sons of the Revolution, 45 patriots of the War of Independence have been identified as buried in Spring Grove Cemetery, with another 10 listed in memoriam, though their graves have been lost. One of those lost graves was for Joshua Wyeth, a participant in the Boston Tea Party, a volunteer at the Battle of Bunker Hill, and a soldier in the Continental Army. Diligent work by Wyeth's family, though, has made sure he will not be forgotten. Tina Wyeth Baker and her brother Jeff Wyeth extensively researched the family's genealogy, but they could find no grave for Joshua, the brother of their fourth great-grandfather, despite his service in the founding of the nation. Joshua Wyeth was born on October 6, 1758, in Cambridge, Massachusetts. In 1820, while living in Springfield, Ohio, he testified to his military service in the Revolutionary War for his pension application. At age 15, he was working as an apprentice blacksmith when he joined the mob on December 16, 1773, and threw the East India Company's tea overboard into Boston Harbor as a protest against British tyranny and taxation. The men swore an oath of secrecy so the British could not identify them and retaliate. When conflict erupted with the British, Wyeth volunteered at the Battle of Bunker Hill on June 17, 1775. He then enlisted in the Continental Army and served as a private in Captain Eliphalet Newell's company, the 1st Regiment of the Massachusetts Line under Colonel Henry Knox, and then as a blacksmith in the Corps of Artificers. He participated in the battles of Long Island at Flatbush, Harlem Heights, and White Plains in 1776. In his later years, Wyeth lived in Springfield and then Cincinnati. It was in Cincinnati that Wyeth finally opened up about his involvement in the Boston Tea Party. In fact, Wyeth himself may have been responsible for popularizing the phrase Boston Tea Party. A widely circulated newspaper account in 1826 mentioned, quote, a temperate, hardy old veteran, end quote, in Cincinnati who, quote, often boasts of the Boston Tea Party, end quote, referring to the party of men, not the event, which until then had been called, quote, the destruction of tea in Boston Harbor, end quote. This was near the country's 50th anniversary, and there was renewed interest in the revolution. In the July 1827 edition of Western Monthly Review, published in Cincinnati, editor Timothy Flint carried an account by Wyeth of his involvement in the Boston Tea Party, nearly in his own words. It was the first circulated first person account by a participant to be published over 53 years after the historic event. Here are excerpts. Our numbers were between 28 and 30. Of my associates, I only remember the names of Frothingham, Meade, Martin, and Grant. We were met together one evening, talking over the tyranny of the British government, such as the heavy duties, shutting up the port of Boston, the murdering of Mr. Gray's family, sending people to England for trial, and sundry other acts of oppression. Our indignation was increased by having heard of the arrival of the tea ships at this time. We agreed that if the tea was landed, the people could not stand the temptation and would certainly buy it. We came to a sudden determination to make sure work of it by throwing it all overboard. We agreed, in order as much as we might, to prevent ourselves from being discovered, to wear ragged clothes, and disfigure ourselves as much as possible. We concluded to meet an old building at the head of the wharf, and to fall in one after another, as if by accident, so as to not excite suspicion. After having pledged our honor that we would not reveal our secret, we separated. At the appointed time, we all met according to agreement. We were dressed to resemble Indians as much as possible. We had smeared our faces with grease and soot or lamp black. We should not have known each other except by our voices, and we surely resembled devils from the bottomless pit rather than men. We boarded the ship, which was moored by the wharf. Some of our numbers jumped into the hold and passed the chests to the tackle. As they were hoisted on deck, others knocked them open with axes, and others raised them to the railing and discharged their contents overboard. We stirred briskly in the business from the moment we left our dressing room. We were merry in an undertone at the idea of making so large a cup of tea for the fishes, but were as still as the nature of the case would admit. No more words were used than what were absolutely necessary. Our most intimate acquaintances among the spectators had not the least knowledge of us. I never labored harder in my life, and we were so expeditious that although it was late in the evening when we began, we had discharged the whole three cargoes before morning dawn. It may be supposed that there was much talk about this business next morning. The Tories, civil, military, and spies made a great fuss and called the business divers hard names. Proclamations and rewards to procure detection were all to no purpose. We pretended to be as zealous to find out the perpetrators as the rest. We often talked with the Tories about it. We were all so close and loyal that the whole affair remained in Egyptian darkness. We used sometimes afterwards to meet and talk the affair over, never failing to end by drinking the Hardy Boys of America forever. And that ends the account. The Boston Gazette challenged the accuracy of Wyeth's account, claiming he was probably just a spectator, but his errors are relatively minor. For instance, Wyeth said the ships were in Hancock's Wharf, but it was Griffin's Wharf. Wyeth hadn't been in Boston in decades, so it is likely he was confused. But Wyeth was correct about who else was at the party. The first list of participants in the Boston Tea Party, not published until 1835, included Nathaniel Frothingham, John Martin, Moses Grant, and a, quote, Mr. Wyeth, end quote. French artist Auguste Herveau depicted Wyeth in the crowd in his painting of the Marquis de Lafayette's landing at Cincinnati in May 1825, along with prominent local citizens William Henry Harrison, William Lytle, Daniel Drake, Jacob Burnett, Flint, and Hiram Powers, whether they were present at the event or not. The painting has been lost, probably in Europe. Wyeth died on January 22, 1829, with a funeral at his home on Longworth Street, a street on the west side of downtown between 5th and 6th Streets that was wiped out by Interstate 75. There is no record of his burial. So Tina Wyeth Baker sought help from Christopher Smith, reference librarian at the Public Library of Cincinnati and Hamilton County, who determined that Wyeth was probably buried at the Episcopal and Presbyterian burying grounds on 12th Street and over the Rhine, though there are no known burial records of the site. In 1855, the city bought the grounds to convert them into Washington Park. Notices were placed in newspapers calling for families to pay to move their loved ones to the Wesleyan or Spring Grove cemeteries, but most, like Wyeth, had no family nearby and were not moved. The remaining stones were laid on the ground, and 3 feet of dirt was poured over the graves. When Washington Park was renovated in 2010, crews uncovered dozens of graves. 3 found tombstones were erected in the park as symbolic of the past graveyard, and the discovered remains were moved to Spring Grove. Those bodies left undisturbed were covered over and forgotten. Wyeth's grave is probably still under an undisturbed portion of the park opposite the south wing of Music Hall. Armed with this knowledge, in 2014, Baker was able to get approval from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs for a memorial tombstone for Wyeth. It was placed in Spring Grove, where his remains should have been reburied. "There are many monuments to honor the leaders of our drive for independence," Baker wrote. "But for the ones who did the grunt work, they are lucky if a stone in a cemetery still marks their contribution. At the very least, all veterans deserve a memorial marker for their grave." The Hardy Boys of America forever. Now we're on to Chapter 4, and these are the medical pioneers. Cincinnati can lay claim to pioneers of medicine, such as Dr. Albert B. Sabin at Children's Hospital Research Foundation, who developed the oral live virus polio vaccine that helped eradicate polio. There were also pioneers in the other sense, in the days when Cincinnati was still on the frontier. And first up, we have Dr. Daniel Drake. Dr. Daniel Drake was the foremost physician in what was the West's largest city in the first half of the 19th century, and was once the most famous man in Cincinnati. For the breadth of Drake's accomplishments, historian W. H. Venable likened him to Benjamin Franklin. Quote, "So many good works did he undertake, so much did he accomplish, that I think he may be called with propriety the Franklin of Cincinnati. Today his name," and that ends the quote, "today his name adorns the Daniel Drake Center in Hartwell, but as early as 1909, biographer Otto Jutner felt that Drake was, quote, entirely forgotten, end quote. Drake was born on October 20, 1785, in Essex County, New Jersey. When he was 2, his family moved to Maize Lick, Kentucky, which at the time was still Indian country. His parents were poor and barely literate, but Drake aspired for more. He befriended Dr. William Goforth, who inspired him to become a doctor, and moved to Cincinnati in 1800 to apprentice under him, even though Goforth had no medical degree. Medical training in America at that time followed the preceptorship plan, an arrangement in which a student apprenticed under an established physician for about 4 years until he had accumulated enough knowledge to be called a doctor. Nonetheless, in 1805, Drake left to attend the University of Pennsylvania to study under the preeminent physician Benjamin Rush, and eventually earned his medical degree. Drake returned to Cincinnati and quickly built a reputation as a laudable physician, scientist, writer, and visionary. His most noted achievement was the founding of the Medical College of Ohio in 1819, the second medical school west of the Allegheny Mountains. It merged with the University of Cincinnati in 1896 and is now the UC College of Medicine. Drake also started and ran the medical department of Cincinnati College from 1835 to 1839, and he served many years on the faculty at Transylvania University in Lexington, Kentucky, and the Louisville Medical Institute. In 1821, he petitioned for the creation of Commercial Hospital and Lunatic Asylum, the nation's first teaching hospital at 12th Street and Central Avenue. The hospital became Cincinnati Hospital, and in 1915 was replaced by Cincinnati General Hospital, now known as University Hospital. Drake's interests and influence were varied. He wrote essays on medicine, medical education, and forest preservation. He authored several books on the early days of Cincinnati, noting as well the region's weather and geology. His book Natural and Statistical View, or Picture of Cincinnati, in 1815, gave him a national reputation. He suggested routes for a canal system that eventually became the Miami and Erie Canal, and he was an early proponent for a railroad to the east. In 1818, he helped create the Western Museum, a repository of scientific artifacts to which he donated his extensive collection of minerals, mammoth bones, and antiquities. Drake hired artist John James Audubon as the museum's taxidermist and to set up exhibits. Recognizing his talent, Drake arranged for a display of Audubon's bird drawings and suggested that Audubon continue the work of Alexander Wilson's ornithology portraits for the Western region, advice the wildlife artist took to heart to create his seminal Birds of America. As a result of Drake's 1833 speech extolling the virtues of the buckeye tree and his proposal for it as the state emblem, Ohio became the Buckeye State. In many ways, Daniel Drake is the most unique figure in the history of American medicine, wrote Sir William Osler of Johns Hopkins University. He literally made Cincinnati. He founded nearly everything that is old and good in that city. Drake died on November 5, 1852, and is buried in Spring Grove Cemetery. Dr. John Shaw Billings, an 1860 graduate of the Medical College of Ohio, who as Surgeon General built up the National Library of Medicine, admired Drake, quote, as a man whose fame, as compared with that of his contemporaries, will probably be greater a century hence than it is today, and whose name should be among the first of the illustrious dead of the medical profession in the United States, end quote. And now, next in our chapter on medical pioneers, the first cesarean section in America. Dr. John Lambert Richmond followed Drake's path from humble beginnings to frontier medicine. Appropriately, he studied under Drake. Richmond's place in the annals of medicine was secured on a stormy night in 1827, when he performed a harrowing backwoods cesarean section, the first to be recorded in America. Richmond was born on April 5, 1785, near Chesterfield, Massachusetts, and grew up in western New York. With just 2 weeks of formal schooling, Richmond was self-taught and well-learned. He studied Latin and Greek from lessons pinned to his sleeves while he worked. He toiled away in fields or down in coal mines to support his wife and 10 children. Seeking opportunities westward, the family settled in Cincinnati in 1817. Richmond found a job as a janitor in the building that housed Drake's Medical College of Ohio. He boldly asked Drake to allow him to attend lectures in exchange for half his meager wages. In 1822, Richmond was in the second class to graduate from the medical college, making him one of the few accredited doctors in the West. He settled in Newtown, a village 10 miles east of downtown Cincinnati, where he served as both the town doctor and a Baptist minister for a church on Clough Road. On Sunday, April 22, 1827, Richmond was summoned from the church to attend to Miss E.C., a free black woman across the Little Miami River who was suffering convulsions through a difficult labor. A storm was raging, and the doctor had to row a skiff across the swollen river to reach her, 7 miles away. A few years later, Richmond reported the dramatic events of that night in Drake's Western Journal of Medical and Physical Sciences. He found that the patient had been in labor for 30 hours. He gave her laudanum and sulfuric ether for her convulsions and put a flannel soaked in hot spirits to her feet. It is worth noting that the use of sulfuric ether as anesthetic was not announced for another 2 decades. As Richmond described the conditions, the log cabin was newly constructed, and the crevices had not yet been chinked. There was no floor but the dirt. Midwives held up blankets to block the wind from blowing out the lone candle. The patient was in severe pain. With no help coming and little medicine available, Richmond determined that she would die if he did not operate. Feeling a deep and solemn sense of my responsibilities, he wrote, with only a case of common pocket instruments, about 1 o'clock at night, I commenced the cesarean section. He had only read about the risky procedure. There was no antiseptic or known anesthesia in those days. He made incisions in the abdomen and uterus and detached the placenta. The uncommonly large child could not be extracted. Believing the baby had perished and, quote, that a childless mother was better than a motherless child, end quote, he cut the fetus to remove it. Following medical practice at the time, he sutured all but the lower 2 inches of the woman's incision, which he closed a few days later. He reported that she recovered and started working again in 24 days. She later married but had no children. Richmond's article was the first to record a cesarean section in America. A few earlier cases have been reported, most notably of Dr. Jesse Bennett of Mason County, Virginia, now in West Virginia, who is said to have successfully operated on his wife, Elizabeth Bennett, on January 14, 1794. But many medical historians, including Jutner, question the accuracy of the Bennett claim, noting that the only evidence of the operation was an essay by a friend of Dr. Bennett, published nearly a century afterward in 1892. In 1912, the McDowell Medical Society of Cincinnati erected a 5-foot-tall granite monument on Church Street in Newtown, honoring Dr. Richmond and, quote, the first cesarean section in America, end quote. Today, about 1/3 of births in America are by C-section. And with that, we'll stop for today. I've only got one short paragraph left in this, but we'll have to pick it up the next time on Los Anaville Times. Till then, this is John Pauley. Have a great week. The Los Anaville Times is made possible in part by a grant from the Kenwood Silverton Madera Kiwanis Incorporated.